Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. A special welcome to club members watching live online. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'll be moderating today's discussion. I should mention that today's program is being held in association with American Leadership Forum Silicon Valley in view of the topic, which is leadership. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and author of the new book, Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. A native of Pennsylvania, from 1965 to 2000 when he retired, Anthony Zinni rose in the ranks from second lieutenant in the Marine Corps to four-star general. He served two tours of duty in Vietnam, during the second of which he was wounded. In subsequent years, he commanded various Marine field units, including those with responsibility for natural disaster and humanitarian response in the Philippines, Turkey, Iraq, and the former Soviet countries. He commanded the force that protected UN troops during their withdrawal from Somalia between 1994 and 96. In 1997, he became commander of the U.S. Central Command, which is based in Florida, and which includes the Middle East and Central Asia, giving him responsibility for the important U.S. military activities in both Iraq and Afghanistan. This is the post today held by General David Petraeus. General Zinni has taught strategy and operations at Marine Basic Camp and at Quantico. He holds a BA from Villanova University and two master's degrees. While he initially opposed the Iraq invasion in 2003 and has in fact critiqued the planning leading to the Iraq invasion, once the U.S. did become involved there, he supported the surge of troops in 2006-2007 as a way to try to bring the war to a conclusion. He also predicted the dangers of terrorism emanating from Afghanistan a long time before the 9/11 attacks. More recently, General Zinni has served as a special envoy for the U.S. with Israel and the Palestinian Authority. He serves on several corporate boards as the chairman and interim CEO of BEA Corporation, and he's affiliated with a number of university institutes and programs. He also has a son who I believe is a captain in the U.S. Marine Corps. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to General Anthony Zinni.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
General Zinni, I'd like to start out just by asking you to describe the very important thesis of your book about the leadership failures that we're seeing in different sectors of U.S. society, essentially the failures in outcomes which you believe are traceable to a failures of leadership.
Yeah. Well, the book is a result emanating from my previous book about how the world had changed so much since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the rise of globalism, the advance of information technology, and a whole series of factors over the last two decades that changed the world drastically. And while I was on the book tour, much like this, and talking about that, I kept getting questions from audiences like this about leadership. And I had a strong sense that people were feeling a crisis in leadership, so much so that I decided to go beyond maybe an anecdotal belief that something was wrong and look what the surveys were saying. I mentioned in this book that I had several surveys that really track American and international views on their leadership in every facet of society, whether it's governance and business or whatever. I was shocked when I looked at the surveys going from 2000 to 2008. By 2008, 77% of the American people felt there was a leadership crisis in virtually every facet of society. Not one element of society did the leadership rise above 50% in approval rating, in other words, a majority. And that was true globally, too. There was not one political leader in the world last year that received above 50% from his constituents and the people he led. And I wanted to know why. And so I looked at people that were failing, organizations that were failing, industries that were failing, and I wanted to see who was actually succeeding. And I came across about 11 factors that marked people that were succeeding, especially those succeeding in businesses or in enterprises that the norm was failure, airline industry, the automobile industry, and many other areas. And these 11 sort of traits sort of identified the exceptions. And it told me there was a new kind of leader. Not so much that there was a lot of difference in the way they led, but they certainly adapted to different things, like this rise of technology and harnessing it and mastering it. But I found certain things about how they approach their leadership role, getting directly to your question, Gloria. One is they are strategic thinkers. They have a future orientation. They look to where they want to bring their organization, their unit, or whatever it is. And they're able not only to have that vision and that visionary approach, they know how to guide their organization to that vision. They tend to be unique decision makers. They tend to be recognitional and intuitive in their ability to see things. They operate and decide more decisively and more quickly. They tend to be great communicators, a lot of charisma, tend to lead from the front. They tend also to think differently. They're much more creative. They're much more analytical in what they do. And so the thrust of the book was in that direction. And I would say if I had to pick one thing that the new leaders do or get more than those that fail, is they understand a very complex environment that they're in now. And again, whether it's business, governance, the military, or whatever. I couldn't resist in the book to throw in a little bit of personal examples and thoughts about leadership. I was embarrassed to say to myself that after almost half a century in leadership roles, I never seriously thought about it. And so this book made me think about it, and so a little bit of that went into this too. So I wanted to analyze my own experiences and say, what did I learn from things I did wrong and things that I might have done right? And so that's part of the book too.
We'll get into this a little more deeply because I thought your discussion of how the military assesses a complex environment and adapts to it is an interesting model, perhaps, for other sectors of society. We have so many examples of failure in recent years. Detroit, the financial industry, the response to Katrina, the California budget situation. You can really sort of go, you know, across society and look at some very negative outcomes that we're seeing. And of course, you trace, as I do, this to poor leadership. I'd like to, when you talk about the new leaders that exemplify these characteristics you were mentioning, who are your favorite good leaders? I mean, who do you see, who you really think are models of the new leader?
Right. Well, I mean, clearly you see individual leaders, and I mentioned in the book General David Petraeus, who we, I think most of us know. He had a different approach to Iraq and to the kinds of conflicts we're in today. He thought out of the box. He was much more, as I said before, analytical in the way he looked at things. He invited in contrarian views. He wanted to understand the environment much better. He operated outside the norm. In other words, he did things on the ground that went beyond the military dimension. I was in Iraq last November at the request of General Odierno and Ambassador Crocker at the time to do an assessment as they were looking now at the new administration and how they were going to work the withdrawal over time. And I was surprised to see the number of things the military was involved in that were non-military. Matter of fact, I jokingly said to General Odierno, you're into everything from agriculture to zoos, A to Z. And literally they were. And he was explaining to me, this was from General Petraeus' time and his time with General Petraeus, that they just decided they needed to take this on. If they were going to turn this around, you know, as General Petraeus said, you're not going to shoot your way to success in these environments. It takes more than that. And he saw the scope of the requirement much differently than maybe other military commanders did. You look at a Richard Branson in Virgin Airlines, in an industry that tends to have bankruptcy and failed structures and models, he seems to succeed. And then you see companies. I mean, let's take the automobile industry. Why does Toyota and Honda get it? Why, when you open up Consumer Reports, they're always number one in the ratings consistently? And why didn't American automobiles get it? What is it about the leadership in there, their ability to assess consumer desires, needs, and expectations, while others didn't? And so there are many examples, not only of individual leaders, but groups of leaders in given organizations, too, that come out when you look at, especially at industries or places or organizations that tend to have failure is the norm, or lack of success is the norm. The one or two that get it pop up.
Talk a little bit about this concept of surveying the environment and understanding a changing environment. How does the military do that? How does it develop military leaders who get that the strategic environment has completely changed and new tactics are necessary?
We, you know, obviously in the military, we think in terms of three levels: the tactical, the operational, and the strategic. And you begin very simply at the tactical level, making what we call an estimate of the situation. And obviously, as you move up to a strategic level, the same principles apply as to how you assess your environment. You know, as a young enlisted man or lieutenant, you know, I was taught about analyzing mission, the enemy, the friendly forces we had, the terrain, you know, the fire support you have available, the logistics, and those sorts of things. As you move up, for example, when I was in U.S. Central Command, now you're thinking at a strategic level, you're assessing cultures, you're assessing the political environment. Obviously, it expands much greater than the maybe more simple tactical level estimates. But you have a template, or you have a means of understanding the component parts of your environment and how to assess them. What you have to be tuned into is that your environment could get additional component parts. I mentioned before that the changes that have occurred in the last two decades, and let's take, for example, the rise of information technology. Today's military commander has a flood of data coming into him, and he could not process that data in the way we operated 20 or 30 years ago. And we have now learned that we need to process data more efficiently, more analytically, and faster than ever before. And so just the way you process that, just the way you understand that you're not the only one with access to that kind of technology, even as simple as maybe the threats we face now with extremist groups, they have mastered the internet, the cell phone, the communication and information technology means, and even in the most simplistic way, use it very effectively. And so there are new elements, new complexities that come into an environment, and you have to be attuned to these, because if you're not, they change so drastically, and your competitor, whether it's the enemy on a battlefield or a competitor in business, if they get it faster than you, you're going to certainly be left behind.
All right, let's focus in on one popular whipping boy at the moment, which is Detroit and the American auto industry, which since the 1970s at least had a lot of signals that their environment was changing, since the oil shocks of the 70s, that people were going to want more fuel-efficient cars and so on. And Toyota jumped on that, and Honda jumped on that, and so on. How do you assess Detroit's failure to get that changing environment?
Well, I think if you dominate a market for a while, you fall into the trap, certainly, of deciding, I can tell the people what they need or want. I don't need to listen to what they need or want. And so we not only had the wrong kinds of cars that American people wanted, we didn't have the quality. They had really, by their own admission, fallen behind. We didn't have the kinds of quality cars, dependability, reliability that you saw coming in from the Toyotas and Hondas and others. In addition to that, you know, I think those companies that came in really tuned into the American public wanting that kind of personal service, too. I don't know if those of you, you know, have been able to compare service back in those days when you went to an American car dealership, and what happened when the Toyotas and Hondas came in. They went out of their way to make sure that when you brought your car in for service, you had that personal treatment, you know, the loaner, the making sure that you were accommodated in any way. And now American car dealerships obviously have caught on, but they lost ground in that kind of personal touch. And so what happens is sometimes when you don't think you have competition to worry about, it's going to sneak up on you because they're going to read the customer base the same way. You can think about that in political terms, too, in terms of taking the voter for granted. And all of a sudden, I mean, you could see in the last election that probably no one would have predicted that this outcome as to who the president might be by such a landslide, maybe even a year or two before. But there was a case where they understood the voter, they understood how to make that appeal, and slid past many of the favorites within the Democratic Party and certainly the Republican Party, and really. We don't think of it as a surprise now, but I would bet to say 2 years before the campaign began, if somebody would have said a raw, new, young senator from Illinois would suddenly dominate the campaign and artfully use information technology, his appeal to youth, and a number of other things to sort of capture the campaign, we would have never believed it. But there you have it, you know, and again, reading the environment just the right way.
So what happens, again, sticking with Detroit just as an example, what happens that allows leaders to rise to the top in a certain sector or company who are not processing the information coming in from the environment? I noted in your book, you know, some interesting concepts. For instance, that within an organization, loyalty is not a primary value. There are other values that are more important than simply loyalty to a certain person or within the organization. What are the qualities that would have prevented this lack of perception?
To go into the point about loyalty, I say in the book that I have a chapter part of a chapter. It's entitled "The Curse of Loyalty and the Blessing of Integrity." And organizations, you know, today organizations talk about core values. They select a handful of values that are their signature or discriminator values that they want to emphasize. And those that place loyalty at the top, I think, are doomed to fail because it's blind loyalty. That's what it ends up being. And loyalty is then put over honesty, integrity, transparency. And those who put integrity and honesty at the top and say that trumps loyalty, more than loyalty to me and the organization, I want you to be honest, I want you to be open, not fearing saying things that we need to hear, even if you think we don't want to hear it at the leadership level. And when you value that and you have that trust, these tend to be the better organizations. They deal with reality and not the world the way they want it to be. And so this kind of trust, more involvement in bringing people into the decision-making process. I talk about in the book participatory decision-making, which says, look, I'm the boss and I'll make the ultimate decision, but in the process leading up to the decision, I want to invite the whole organization into this. I want to tap in to what you know, to what you see, to what you bring to the organization. And I think what happens sometimes, too, the first part of your question, Gloria, about how people rise to the top that maybe we wonder how they got there, certainly how they got the compensation they did after they've destroyed an organization. Sometimes it's the leader development process that produces people without paying attention to whether the product of the process, the leader, is really in tune with today's environment and what's going on. And that's why leader development programs have to be dynamic, and you have to constantly be reassessing the program and how you're building the leader so it's in tune with what's happening in today's world.
So you mentioned some of your experiences, the Marine Corps being very focused on developing leadership. You wrote about the Military Leadership Reaction Course, mm-hmm. which is a very active course that young Marines go through to develop leadership skills. Could you describe that type of exercise?
Yeah, it was really my first experience. I joined the Marine Corps when I was 18 years old. The first day on campus, I was the only one in my family to go to college, and somebody told me you had to join the military while you're in college. I didn't know that wasn't true, so I enlisted in the Marine Corps. And to my great dear old Italian mother was a shock when I came home from my first day of college, and she said, "How was the first day of college?" I said, "I joined the Marines," and you know, that was a shock. And I wasn't sure what I joined, but I went to Quantico for my initial training and in what we called a platoon leader class. You went away in the summers while you were in school, and then when you graduated, you were commissioned. And my first experience was this leadership reaction course, which we still use in the Marine Corps, and this was back in 1962. And it was a series of compartments, large compartments about the size of this room, a whole set of them sort of walled off. And the instructors walked along the walls on the top. And they would break us down into groups of about five or six, and they would give us a task. They never told us who was in charge, unlike other things we did, where they appointed somebody as the fire team leader or squad leader for that event. No one was designated to be in charge. The tasks we were given were either impossible or very difficult, you know, at best. And they threw us in there and gave us the pressure of time and screaming sergeants and told us to get the task done. And what they wanted to see, obviously, is who took charge and how much others respected him or assigned that sort of leadership role and were willing to accept it, how the team worked together, how you participated as a member of the team and what you did for the organization. Obviously, they were interested in the innovation and creativity, some of these things, and I described some of the events in the book were, like I said, impossible or near to impossible, but a bunch of young 18-year-olds, you know, we don't know that, and we struggle to find a solution. And afterwards, I thought a lot about that particular experience. I mean, well after that, because it had a lot of elements of leadership. How do you identify a leader? How does a group pick the leader that they're going to follow and decide on it? How do you fall in and create a team and you gel the team and make it work together? How do you solve a problem? How do you analyze the problem you're faced with, especially with the group, and in some sort of structured way, especially under pressure, come up with it? So it was rich in all the elements that make good leadership. And to me, a very simple exercise. As a matter of fact, now, many businesses and corporations and others bring their people to Quantico for that leadership reaction course and put their executives through it, you know, because it's not only fun, but, you know, it shows them in that light and under that kind of pressure. And you sort of get an idea as to who maybe, I don't want to use the term natural leader because I think that's overused, but there are some people that naturally will step up to the challenge.
There are so many components of good leadership, as you have outlined in your book. The ethics, the ability to assess a complex environment, analytical capabilities, the relationship of leaders with the led, how they get input from those they lead, and so on and so forth. Would you say, in general, that the attention to this in various sectors of our society, within companies, within government, the government, and so on, is less than it should be? In other words, should there, you say some companies send their executives to Quantico and so on, but that's probably relatively rare. Should there be more attention on an ongoing basis to development of all of these various qualities related to leadership?
I think you're seeing in larger companies, the company I'm with now, BAE Systems, we're a very large company, and certainly we could afford a strong leader development program. We invest a lot into our leader development program, beginning with very young leaders, and it's a progressive program. We assign certain positions within the company that we call rotational in order to broaden experience. So we see a young leader, not only do we put him through these leadership courses at different phases of his career, we move him into different positions to give him that sort of broad breadth of experience. But obviously not every company can afford that. I see now, though, in the universities and the business schools, I taught at Duke University last year at the Sanford Leadership Center. And the Leadership Center not only had a discipline in its own right on leadership, but you had people from the business school, ROTC, political science majors, all young people aspiring to be leaders that took courses in this. I was on the radio show earlier today, and an interesting call-in from a woman who said that she felt strongly, and I think this is a good point, that we need to begin this in high school. We need to start thinking in high school about emphasizing the qualities of good leadership, especially, I mean, you alluded to ethical behavior, you know, the kind of moral and ethical behavior we expect, sort of what I define in the book as the building of the code. Each of us individually have a code. Our organization is going to be required to have a code. I think many of the failures we've seen in business is the lack of that kind of code, the adherence to the code, the instilling of that code into the culture of the organization. Again, I've been with several companies and corporations that invest a lot in that. And boards of directors now are required to have governance committees, ethics committees to oversee that in companies. It is unfortunately a result of bad experiences and regulatory and legislative action that require it many times. It is fortunately now become good business. If you can get yourself a reputation of being a highly ethical company, the theme now in most corporate places is and headquarters is corporate responsibility or corporate social responsibility, and the emphasis on that now is being defined. It begins with taking care of your employees, putting a quality product on the market, and doing it at a fair price. Paying attention to your stakeholders, including your customers, those that own the stock, the board members, your suppliers, everybody who depend on you and have needs, and you depend on them. And so it's an interactive process, and you constantly take their pulse as to how you're doing. If you don't, you're going to fail. And I think that kind of behavior has to be checked, and you have to ensure that your customer sees that, your stakeholders see that, your employees live it, and most importantly, your leaders live it. I mean, they are beyond just leaders, they're role models, and they have to live that code that you decide is what you're going to have your organization stand for and be all about.
General Zinni, there are many, many questions from the audience, both here and online. So I'm going to work through some of those questions.
Okay.
And some of them have to do with some current military issues and foreign policy, as well as the leadership questions that you're addressing. But on the leadership issue, one person here in the audience would like you to name five great world leaders in the world today.
Five great world leaders today. Oh, you know, I just told you that nobody in the world rated their political leader above 50%.
One or two would be fine.
And you're asking me to...
Your personal picks. Who do you like?
You know, I've seen leaders, and maybe to go back a little bit too, I've seen very courageous leaders. People like King Hussein of Jordan that took a great risk for peace, and obviously President Sadat, who didn't pay with his life, Prime Minister Rabin, who paid with his life for, and unfortunately the peacemakers who take great risks suffer the most, and that's been the nature certainly lately of conflicts and maybe historically, and to me that always struck a chord with me. Those that do things like that and take the greatest gamble, exercise the greatest leadership, and again take the greatest personal risk too, seem to pay the price for that, and they've impressed me in terms of what I've seen. I was fortunate enough, and this may not be exactly in the world leaders, I was fortunate enough to work for Colin Powell, who I respect tremendously. I thought his sense of the world and what was going on in it, how we should function in it, I thought he was that insightful. I just wish that administration would have paid more attention to him in my time with him. I certainly think... That you run into people that have wisdom that come with great years. My first day on the job as the envoy to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the first person I met was Shimon Peres, who I thought was an exceptionally wise gentleman, and you could tell from the years of experience. And just a little anecdote, when I first arrived there, his first piece of advice, which I remember forever, he said, you're going to meet three kinds of people on both sides in this process. You will meet the righteous, and he said, don't waste your time. You're going to meet the debaters who want to argue with you and score debating points. Don't waste your time. But he said, go into the streets, both on the Israeli and Palestinian side, and meet the people who desperately want to find a way to live in peace with each other. Keep them in mind and focus on them in everything you do, and don't get caught up with others that have a political agenda or motivated by things that you can't change in their view, but you can do something for them. And I thought that was a tremendous amount of wisdom and kept me focused in what I did. So, you know, I've run into a number of people, and of course, being put on the spot, I'll think of 20 later.
We can come back to that. Now, a question from one of our members watching online. Were the troubles we had in Iraq mostly due to problems with leadership or the mission itself?
I think it was leadership. I think that the leadership at the time that made that decision did not invite in enough people who understood the counterarguments to doing this. I mean, think about what was happening there. First of all, and this is a little bit personal, but the plan we had in place when I left was abandoned. They naively thought we could do this with way fewer troops. They didn't understand, you know, the first question we'd ask yourself, why would the plan we had require 380 to 400,000 troops? Why would the chief of staff of the Army, Rick Shinseki, say you need that number? And all the previous commanders of CENTCOM, the previous four who had been involved in developing that plan and advised against it. What is it that they saw? Why were they saying it will not be a, quote, cakewalk or there'll be flowers in the street? What are the potential threats inside and outside Iraq? Why is it that there are serious doubts about a weapons of mass destruction program? Have we taken a serious look at the intelligence and what it's saying and those that counter the intelligence? I think some of the decisions that went counter to people's experience before, disbanding the regular Iraqi army instead of vetting its leadership after we had spent almost 10 years communicating with them, saying the time comes, we won't disband you, we'll pay you, keep you in being, revamp your leadership and use you, because you don't want people on the street with guns. I mean, it's logical. Why did they close the state-owned factories and put people out of work? Why did they go through this ruthless program of de-bathification, alienating many of the people instead of reconciliation, which should have been the mode? So a whole series of bad decisions based on bad assessments and cherry-picking of information, not willing to bring the contrarian views in that they needed to hear, and this sort of over-rosy estimate, and this unbelievable belief that they were going to change things in the Middle East through an intervention that had no relevance to our cause for beginning to enter a conflict based on 9/11 and those that perpetrated it.
Talking about leadership going forward, a question from our audience here, what should our exit look like in Iraq? What infrastructure, military roads, et cetera, must be in place at this time?
I think we know what has to be done, and I think we're doing it. The Iraqi security forces, we've invested a lot in their training, education, providing of equipment. We will have what's called the security assistance program that will remain in support of them, which doesn't mean that's not combat troops. It's providing that training, education, and material support. And it's not only to Iraqi military. It's to we also have programs for Iraqi police and training police, not only involving Americans, but Europeans and others. There's some police structure in Iraq that we don't have, like a national police force that Europeans have, like the Carabinieri or the Guardia Civile or others. And so we have the kinds of mixed training that specializes in the kind of security training they need. I think that's well in place and will work well. And I think the security forces now and in the future as they grow will be able to handle that part of the situation. We have given the Iraqi government every chance to succeed. The first election this year went well. There's two more to come, and I would advise you keep an eye on those, and that'll tell you something about how the people feel about their own government. If it's as successful as the first, meaning there's a good turnout, there isn't, by election observers, any undue influence or inappropriate activities, if the participation level is good, then I think those are other good indicators the government is beginning to take hold. I walked the streets in Baghdad, Basra, elsewhere, talked to some Iraqis about what do you want in the future in this government as Americans leave, and they clearly want their essential services, their government, to be responsive to their very basic needs. They would tell me, I want my electricity on 24/7. I want my garbage picked up. I want my sewage system to work. And this government's going to have to deliver that now, the Maliki government. The government has growing pains. They're not used to this kind of government and a democracy. They have to learn to allocate funds, build programs, make policy. They're a little bit handicapped by the nature of the structure. You know, unlike our government, where the Democrats are in or the Republicans are in and you have a consistent policy, when I went through their ministries talking from the minister and everybody on down, you see a Kurd, Sunni, Shia, Chaldean, Assyrian, whatever, all have different views on things. So a little bit more difficult to get a sort of cohesive, coherent policy, but they're struggling to do it. They have some problems with corruption and other things, as you might expect. I wouldn't overstate that. Can they do it? I think they can. And I think the next year will be telling. One of the most significant problems they have will be the needs and the views of the different groups. Again, the Kurds, the Shia, the Sunni, and being able to accommodate those needs and still have some sort of centralized government direction. Issues like sharing of oil revenues, those are the kinds of things that are going to come up. How much autonomy will go down to local and provincial and regional level, how much authority will be held in Baghdad, have to be sorted out. And the best I can tell you that since General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker, now General Odierno, were in there, we have given them a chance to succeed. Certainly the time for U.S. combat troops is past, and obviously the program to now gear down and to come out is correct. But I would say I'm cautiously optimistic.
Question about President Obama's leadership. How would you evaluate his leadership in killing the F-22 fighter aircraft program?
Well, of course, that began with Secretary Gates, who I have a great deal of respect for. I think Secretary Gates has proven to be a superb Secretary of Defense now in two administrations, and he's made some hard decisions. He's fired four general officers, basically, and one from each service, so you can't say he's prejudiced in any way. But, he made the call, the recommendation on the F-22 and the Army's Future Combat System, two major programs. And of course, the Obama administration supported that and agreed with it. We have a flattening defense budget and probably one that will eventually go down a bit. Secretary Gates came forward and said that we need to ensure that we are properly funding the other elements of government, the so-called smart power, which is a blend of the hard power on the military side and the soft power of diplomacy, development, and other areas. And he has been very clear, as the generals, Admiral Mullins and General Petraeus and others have said, you're not going to shoot your way to success in these kind of conflicts. These other agencies and what they provide are the keys to success. So he's seen the requirement to make sure that the budgets and what we could afford in a shrinking fiscally difficult environment, that they are balanced in many ways. And the Obama administration has embraced this. Most important in all this, though, is that the Congress accepted this. Now, this is tough, and it was bipartisan. Senator McCain backed that decision, along with the president and many Democrats. And, you know, in some congressmen's districts, that means jobs and factories closing. And that becomes a difficult thing to support. But you saw those hard decisions being made on those programs. The administration put them forward, and the Congress approved them. That's good. That's healthy. And even in accordance with the warning we have from General Eisenhower that I often get asked about, and industry stayed out of it, most importantly, and I'm proud to say, since I'm part of that industry now, but industry should not try to work against the strategy that is presented or against the process of political approval. Sometimes I think, you know, the caution that I think Eisenhower had is when you look at the three legs of that stool, the administration and the military and the Pentagon, whose job it is to build the strategy and the requirements, the Congress it is to approve that and the funding, and the industry to respond to the needs. As soon as you get out of that, you have Eisenhower's warning. When industry tries to foist on the military something they don't need, or the politicians do, or the military is gold-plating something and fighting for programs that we can't afford as a nation and resisting the prioritization that has to come from civilian leadership, that's when you get out of whack. And I think that was the essence of Eisenhower's warning. This was a good example when it worked right, thank God.
For those listening and watching outside this room, we're speaking with General Anthony Zinni, a former commander of the U.S. Central Command, and this is the program of the Commonwealth Club of California. From our audience here, General Zinni, you were right about alerting our government about the threat of terrorism prior to 9/11. You were right to advise not to invade Iraq. You were right about the surge. What should our policy be relative to increasing our involvement in Afghanistan?
I should maybe quit at 3-0. I think the President Obama's strategy is the right one. However, it is very ambitious strategy. It's going to be difficult to pull it off. He certainly has not left anything out. There's certainly, I don't think anyone I know that's familiar with the situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan, by the way, I'm recently back from Pakistan, would criticize that there's something missing in the strategy. Here's what he has said are the components of the strategy. The first is internationalizing this conflict and effort. In other words, why should we bear most of the burden? It wasn't just New York and Washington that were attacked. I mean, Madrid, London, and other places have been attacked by the same people, you know, in this environment, al-Qaeda or the al-Qaeda network that emanates from that place. And he is now criticizing the lack of burden sharing and the lack of others that are sharing the burden on the ground. I mean, beside the United Kingdom, Canada, maybe the Dutch and French, there aren't many of this magnificent NATO organization that are willing to put people and troops in harm's way and in risk. And the first point has to be more support for resources and more support for the kinds of external troops you're going to need at least for the next 3 years until we can build the Afghan forces up. The second component that they've identified is the regionalization of the requirement for coordination between and among the Pakistanis, the Afghans, and the Indians, and others in the region. Those are not natural little kumbaya happy fellows out there, and it's going to take us to keep them together. President Obama brought the Afghans and Pakistanis back to Washington at the ministerial level, kind of pushed them in the room together to meet each other, and they went back feeling, you know, this is what we need. They all admit we need a coordinated, cooperative effort. But they know they cannot do it themselves. There's too much between them. There's the bickering and the fighting and the history that makes it difficult. And I would say here, I would like to see more follow-up from our administration, maybe in the region, to create structures to ensure we have this coordination, some sort of executive councils, committees, you know, that have the ministerial level and below working all elements of this conflict. Because if we don't, the bad guys will play one against the other. They'll attack in Mumbai to try to get an Indian reaction. They'll run back and forth across the Pakistan-Afghan border, causing problems and sort of exacerbating the complaints and the finger-pointing that come with that. So there needs to be that regionalization, and it's going to be very difficult. The other component part is the need to build these Afghan security forces. Now, we've wasted 8 years. I mean, 8 years we would think we would have them. The Marines just launched this big operation into Helmand Province, probably the most difficult area in Afghanistan. Thousands of Marines went in there. And I noticed that only 300 Afghan security forces went with these thousands of Marines. And it was because that was all they had that they could muster that would be viable on the ground in that environment. And that's terrible after 8 years of involvement there. And so I think it's going to take 3 to 5 years to build that kind of Afghan security forces, not just military again, police and others to be able to do it. And then the fourth part of this, obviously, is the development of the ability of the governments in Pakistan and particularly Afghanistan, with an election coming up the end of this week, to effectively reach out and touch all the people, not just Karzai or if it's somebody else after the election being just the mayor of Kabul. But there needs to be a reach out there, the influence of the government in a positive way, helping, you know, build clinics, education systems, infrastructure, and see the effects is going to be critically important as we go forward. We're going to have to help, and again, I hope in an international support system, with the resources, and we're going to have to help them build the ability to implement all that. And so those are among the key parts that I see that this very ambitious strategy sees we need to do. I would say what's going to be critically important is keeping American people, their willingness to support this going forward. It's not going to be easy. And then, as I said, the next 3, maybe 5 years are going to be tough. And the president has to, and he's been doing it now, but certainly there are plenty of other crises on his plate, too, that he has to inform people of and stay in touch with. But, you know, you could lose popular support. If you remember back to the Powell Doctrine, the Weinberger Doctrine, we cannot, it's just not in our nature. We aren't subjects of the king or queen. We cannot go into conflict without the support of the American people. Every time that's been attempted or we've attempted to sustain that beyond the will of the people, we've gotten into trouble. And the way you have to keep the will of the American people in this is you have to explain why we're there, what we're doing, and what we're committing to it, and what our expectations are. And I think it's going to be critically important. Now, we're 8 years away from 9/11, and maybe some of the sense of urgency and the sense of threat have waned, unfortunately, and we don't understand how dangerous this is. Not only are those there that perpetrated that event and still intend to do us harm around the world, we have two nuclear powers there, one of which could be destabilized, and that is dangerous for the world. We have the Taliban and others out there that have committed atrocities against their own people, women and young people, that are just unacceptable by the international community. And I don't think we can leave this in their hands. It will spread beyond their borders. But we have to be clear on this in terms of the support that we're willing to provide or will fail in this.
A couple more questions on our tour of the globe, and then we'll get back to some broader leadership questions. Someone here in the room wants to know, is it an impossible dream to consider an established Pakistani counterinsurgency programs in Afghanistan? From hundreds of thousands, would this be a means for the U.S. and NATO to have an exit strategy? I think it means hundreds or thousands of such counterinsurgency forces.
When I was in Pakistan, I talked to the military leadership there. They're not a military that was created to deal with the counterinsurgency. I mean, they're a military from its existence that faced off against one enemy, India, and very much in a conventional and now scary enough a nuclear context. And one of the missions President Clinton sent me on was on CENTCOM is to defuse the situation in Kargil where they were escalating up to what we feared might be something very serious and drastic. And so now they are involved in a counterinsurgency. They're very reluctant to engage against their own people, if you will. So this is very difficult, almost countercultural to their military. And their conventional forces are having to learn the tactics and the hearts and minds business. They're committed to it. I can say that the commander of the military, the senior military general Kiani, did not want to undertake these missions unless he had the full support of the Pakistani people. He does, certainly for now. And I think the atrocities and the overextension of the Taliban, really alarm the people. And that he has that support. He has the support of the media. He wanted to ensure the government would not back away or back down, would be committed to this too. I mean, before they've tried to make deals with the Taliban, the wrong Taliban, and they've been burnt by that, and he has that. So I do think that they are committed to this mission. They are learning how to do the counterinsurgency business. The most difficult thing I see is the resources necessary to continue this. They will have to garrison the military in these regions. They don't have the infrastructure and facilities. That will cost. And remember, Pakistan has a very poor economy. They have displaced a number of people in this area, devastated villages and homes in the fighting. They will have to be rebuilt and repaired. They're going to have to now obviously provide incentives in that region to keep the people and the tribal leaders on their side. And this is going to cost something, and they're not equipped to do it. On the Afghan side, they're basically starting from scratch, and they're not only learning basic military tactics and operations and skills, they're also having to learn how to operate in this sort of insurgency environment, which is very unique and different for them, in a much different environment than even the Pakistanis have. And that's going to be a longer proposition in terms of, as I said before, developing their capabilities. And then in both cases, what the military has to turn this all over to is the police. And they, in neither case, do they have sufficient police forces to be able to stand up and take this on. So in both cases, they're going to have to fully develop exceptional police capability in these areas to replace the military as we go forward in this.
Well, getting back to leadership here at home, a question from someone in our internet audience. Many are frustrated that even with the economic crisis, we're not going to get new leadership for Wall Street. Does Wall Street and also major public companies have effective ways to address failure other than rewarding them with golden parachutes when they're fired?
I think that a number of things have to happen. And first of all, I think it has to begin in business school. I think we need to retrain future Wall Streeters the ethical behavior that's expected of them. It isn't a matter of just doing something because it's legal. We have to go to the ethical and moral level of what you do, and you have to instill that at a very young age, and you have to reward that. And I would say the power of the consumer here is to look at companies that that do things in an ethical way. Banks and financial institutions are where we ought to do business. I think, secondly, you're going to see more activity and growth of regulatory agencies. Sad to say, you know, the Securities Exchange Commission. I have a son-in-law that works in the Securities Exchange Commission. He's the guy that flashes his badge, I want to see your books, and you're in trouble. And, you know, he doesn't want for long hours and long days and many people. And you're beginning to see, I think, growth of more regulatory agencies and legislation to have to correct some of these things. And that will help resolve some of this, too. I think certainly in the terms of the compensation, I would tell you, every company I've worked for since I've been out of the military, including my current one, our bonuses are based on two things. One is the performance of the company. In other words, you can't be getting a guaranteed bonus while the company's not making its numbers. And secondly is your personal performance. All of us have performance objectives. And the way, just to describe how we do it, you're counseled on your performance. Your strengths are described, and the things you need to improve are described. And based on those improving requirements, you're given a set of performance objectives you have to meet over the coming quarter or year. And your bonuses are going to be measured on that. And we also provide coaches and mentors to assist you on that. So it isn't go off on your own devices and improve on your limitations. We help you identify them. We'll help you with the right kinds of people who we trust that will help you improve. And by the way, if you meet your performance objectives, which are very measurable, and the company does well, and logically if we all do the right thing and meet our objectives, it should do well, or we've got a crazy system here somehow, then you're going to get that bonus. You're going to get that that additional success fee or whatever it is that goes with that. Where those kinds of things become guaranteed is where we get in trouble, or where we have a failing executive, and I've seen too much of this, and we just want to get him or her out the door, and we'll say, you know, we don't want our argument, we don't want lawsuits, so just give them the money and let them go. That just breeds more and more of this golden parachutes that reward failure. And we have to say at a time, no, we won't do that, and make the basis and insist the basis for this be on performance. Public companies, not much of a problem, because the stockholders and the board responds to the stockholders, and the stockholders can demand this too. Boards of directors are being held much more responsible now. Sarbanes-Oxley law. Boards of directors can be sued now. Believe me, I'm on 12 boards. You got to make sure you do the right thing. The old school way of showing up four times a year and just signing whatever they put in front of you is gone now. You know, the board is held responsible. As I mentioned, governance and ethics committees, auditing committees that have to drill down into what the company is doing and certify that to the public and to the government and to all the stakeholders. You know, so these are the kinds of things that are happening. They won't be foolproof. There's always somebody that's going to find a way around these things, and we'll see more of this down the road. But I think it's become necessary, and it's helped.
Switching to a different sector, follow-up to failures in Detroit. The UAW membership has not adjusted to changes in globalism and still sees Japan, Mexico, and China as the problem. How could the leaders of the UAW have helped to change the union culture?
Yeah, I think that we have to first understand, obviously, that we expect our workers to have a certain standard of living that is an expectation for us. You know, we aren't going to have the same kind of hourly wages we see in third world countries and places where the requirement to meet certain standards that our quality of life demands, and so there'll be higher rates. But I think, to get to the point more directly, the sense of ownership into a problem has to be borne not just by management, but by those employees across the board. You have to build a different kind of approach to organizations today. You know, it's interesting how things, and I mentioned this in the book, how things evolved. If you went to early in the 20th century or in the flourishing industrial age, there were the bosses and there were the employees. The employees had no choice. They had to work when they had to work, under the conditions they had to work. And obviously there was a revolt, and we created two classes, management and labor. And the only way they came together was through hard bargaining, negotiations, but they saw each other as adversaries. And that's the old model. What you see now is total involvement, participatory involvement, even ownership, where many companies give employees stock. I want you to own part of the company. I want you to have a vested interest in it. You work hard, you ought to share some of the benefits. I want to invite you in on the decision-making. So this idea of labor and management that grew out of the oppression maybe of labor before has now evolved into partnerships. Not everywhere. We still have organizations that are still under this old competitive model. And you see innovative, enlightened organizations that now bring in employees into the process and think of ways to give them a piece of the action, the sense of even actual part of the ownership in a way, so that they're committed to the success of the organization and have a vested interest in its performance. Along with that comes when the times get a little rough, everybody then has to make sacrifices. And you can see this now in retirement plans, pension plans, and other things that are happening where the good times aren't there now. And it's going to be far less in terms of benefits. And but again, I want to go back to the earlier question. That pain has to be shared from the oak corner office with the oak paneling all the way down to the factory floor, too. It just can't all be pushed on the lower-ranking employees. It has to be shared with management, too, and it has to be open and transparent. And now the kinds of companies I'm seeing, you see much more of this kind of collective approach and sense of ownership and distributing the good times and the bad times in some sort of proportionate way. And I think that's the model for the future.
How did you personally become or grow to be a good leader?
Well, you know, I think it comes from trial. Well, if I am, it comes from trial and error. I think that the greatest leadership teacher is experience, not just having the experience, but being able to analyze it and learn from the experiences, good and bad, not just experience itself. I have a quote in the book from Frederick the Great, and you know, somebody asked him who was the most experienced member of his army, and he pointed to a mule, said, made every campaign, still a jackass, you know. But, you know, so it doesn't matter that you just can count experiences. That doesn't get it. You have to analyze those experiences and say, what did I just learn from this? And it's amazing if you think in those terms and you have mentors and people that can help you think about that, leader development programs that say let's look at what you just went through, or let's put you through some experiences. Let's give you different kinds of assignments. Or nowadays, you know, in the military and elsewhere, we have computer simulations and other means of putting you through experiences and seeing how you do. We also allow people to fail. You know, we're going to put you through these things and don't worry if you make a mistake. Don't try to be perfect. We're not going to evaluate you here. This is to build up your experiences, and we'll assess it and show you where you need to improve, but it's no harm, no foul in this environment. And I've been fortunate enough to go through a lot of those experiences, have the right role models and coaches and mentors that help me think about that. And I can go back to experiences as a young lieutenant in Vietnam now and draw lessons from that I couldn't immediately after that, because now I have a broader perspective and understanding and analytical ability to go back and say, that event on that ground, you know, at this point, I can understand what happened better, and I can draw a leadership lesson or a competency lesson from it that maybe I couldn't have immediately afterward or at the time.
I'm glad you brought up mentorship, because I think nothing teaches good leadership like a role model who is doing it. How can society, schools, universities foster new leaders who understand their environment better? How can you teach leadership? If so, what would the curriculum look like at a university? You've answered that in part, but there are several questions along these lines.
Yeah, I always like to begin, and I've taught and consulted on leadership a lot over, especially the last couple of decades. And the first thing I do with the potential leaders or people aspire to be leaders, I want them to find out who they are. I have a little drill I do with my students that, sometimes gets them a little flustered. I hand them a piece of paper, and this is sort of the first session, and at the top I have a line that says name. I want them to believe I'm going to collect it. I tell them, make sure you print your name clearly on this. And in the middle of the paper, I have a dotted line. And I tell them, I'm going to ask you two questions, one to be answered above the line and below the line. And they say, well, he's going to collect the paper. So I said, here's the first question, top of the line. And I'm not going to expand on it. You just got to deal with it as I present it. The question is, who are you? Now write. Ah, they go. They start to write and write. And you could see them thinking and writing and thinking and writing. And at the end, I said, okay, now I'm not going to collect the paper. I'm not even going to call on you. You won't have to say what you thought, wrote, or anything else. It's just for you. And now at the bottom of the paper, I'm going to ask you a second question, which you will answer for yourself. And the question is, who am I? Now answer it honestly. Nobody's going to collect your paper. And they write and write and write. And then I said, now look at the bottom and look at the top. You thought I would collect it. What did you write at the top? Is that who you really are? If you were honest with yourself in the bottom, there should be a difference, because that's your resume at the top, you know? After one of the classes in Duke when I did this, these were all seniors, this angry young man came up to me afterwards. I said, what's the matter? He said, what I wrote at the top was pure BS, you know? And he said, I'm angry at myself. And I said, well, you know, that's natural. I mean, yeah, but this is the first step in training and educating leaders, finding out who you are. What are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? What do I need to work on? What are my values? What do I hold dear? What do I want to be? We talk about it in the class after that little drill, the ways in which you could have answered those questions. Did you describe yourself by your occupation, by your family, by your ethnicity, by your, you know, your set of values? How did you describe yourself? There's no right answer or wrong answer, but what does that say about you when you say, I want to tell you who I am? And then what does it say about you when you are honest and you introspective and say to yourself, who am I? Where am I in my life and what I want to do? So all leadership has to begin with this self-evaluation. Many companies now, and the military and others, do personality testing. I object to companies that use it as a means of trying to identify future leaders. I think that's wrong. You give the Myers-Briggs or these tests for the individual themselves. Look, for whatever value these sets of tests are, this is what it says about you, about your characteristics, your personality, and that's very valuable. You should use that. And then where they feel they need improvement or they want to expand, that's where the coaching and the mentoring and the kinds of courses and everything are shaped to help them. But I think that's where leadership begins.
How does one lead across sectors? People today narrow the range of voices they hear. Conservatives have their sources, progressives have theirs. It almost seems that the crisis is about our inability to follow. How do leaders reach across the lines to bring people together?
I have a chapter in a book called The Led, you know, Those We Lead, because you can't just talk about leader and leadership and stay focused on the leader. And this is another thing I noticed in successful leaders today. We have a very diverse group of people we lead. I don't care what area or field or of endeavor you are. And I don't only mean diversity by race or by gender or ethnic origin or whatever. There are six generations in the workforce now, starting with mine. You know, I'm part of the silent generation, pre-baby boomer. And then you go through generations X, Y, or whatever. Coming out of the universities and high school now is the new silent generation. Six generations, they're all very different. So you not only have horizontal diversity, you have vertical diversity in terms of age and groups. And each of those, and I use examples in the book that I won't bore you with here, of how you have to appeal to each. So now, effective leadership means you can't take a one-size-fits-all. Different backgrounds, different ways people look at the world, different times that they grew up and things that influenced them, different origins that led them to where they are. Much more difficult environment for leadership. But the leaders that get it can touch every one of those people they lead and can touch that diversity and connect to it. And so when we develop leaders, we have to make sure they're tuned in and understand that diversity and how to connect to it. You can't assume that there's one model out there or one monolithic entity that you're dealing with. You won't connect. You'll miss it. You'll miss certainly the vast majority of the people you're trying to lead.
Well, General Zinni and our audiences here and online, we're at the coming to the end of our program. I'd just like to put out a personal view and have you react to it to tie up our program. I want to thank you for posing this topic of the state of leadership in America and how to improve it. I think there isn't a more important discussion we could be having at this time, because I think we're seeing across many sectors that the leadership that we're advancing forward in the political sector, in the corporate sector, and so on, is not up to the challenges that we're facing. And I think we see the result of this in the difficulties in the economy and in so many other areas. So I just think this is the number one conversation we need to be having in this country, and I'd just like you to react to that.
Well, I think it's true. I mean, I think we are in very confusing, complex times. And in times like this, when we see issues like the economy, national security, you know, our own well-being in so many different ways challenged, the focus and the cry is for leadership and to get us through, to help us understand it and to get us through this patch. And I agree that there can't be anything more important than this right now. We aren't going to find a technological solution to these things. We're going to have to find a human solution in those we choose to represent us and be our leaders in every aspect of society.
I commend to everyone here and everyone listening to continue this discussion, continue thinking about this for the sake of our country and our success in the future. And I thank Anthony Zinni, General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and a wise leader in his own right, for posing this question and putting a book out on the market that stimulates discussion about this. So thank you to you. Thank you to all of those listening and watching the Commonwealth Club. And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned.